Loud. Go Loud presents Magnified with Matt Cooper. Proudly sponsored by Volkswagen Financial Services Business Leasing. Move your business forward with a fleet of commercial or passenger vehicles. Build your fleet to your expectations. Visit vwfs.ie/business.
Volkswagen Financial Services is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
Hello and welcome to this latest episode of Magnified with Matt Cooper. And it's a little bit different today because this was recorded in front of a live audience at the Blockchain Ireland conference, which took place at Trinity College recently. I got the opportunity to interview Anthony Scaramucci. You must know the name. Remember, he was infamous for spending just 11 days as the White House press spokesman before Donald Trump fired him. Fired him because of a whole batch of profanities in a recorded conversation with a journalist, which he thought was off the record, but he'd never actually said that. And even Trump couldn't take the opprobrium which followed as a result of this gaffe. He has, though, been a loyal servant of Donald Trump in the past, but has now turned against him entirely and is the co-host of the exceptionally good podcast The Rest is Politics US with Kathy Kay. As well as being a terrific political commentator and insider, he also has a deep knowledge of the investment markets, and his company is very involved in investing in cryptocurrency. So part of this podcast today looks at financial markets and cryptocurrency, but perhaps explains it in a way that I haven't heard explained as well in the past. And he also goes into politics about Donald Trump, recorded just the day before Donald Trump was found guilty in a New York court and became a felon. So we don't go into whether Donald Trump should be jailed for that or the outcome of the trial, but he certainly has very strong views about the suitability of Donald Trump to return to the White House as president again. So I hope you enjoy Anthony Scaramucci. My thanks to Blockchain Ireland for allowing me to use the interview. And of course, my thanks to Volkswagen Financial Services Business Leasing. Move your business forward with a fleet of BEV electric vehicles. Build your fleet to your expectations. Visit wvfs.ie/business. And remember, Volkswagen Financial Services is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. So here is your podcast. Here is Anthony Scaramucci. Anthony, thank you very much for being with us.
It's great to be with you guys, Matt. Just before you ask the questions, I was looking up. So Bitcoin last year at this time, 26,000. I've got a block clock in front of me. It's at 68,000. So I guess the question for the audience is, where will Bitcoin be a year from now? And so just something to think about. I mean, I have my opinion, but just something for everybody to think about. So it pays to be patient with Bitcoin. But thank you for having me.
Anthony, I'm an outsider here, so excuse me if I maybe express degrees of skepticism, maybe coming from a position of relative ignorance. But I've been lucky enough, for example, to interview Michael Lewis about his book, The Big Short. Adam McKay, when he turned it into a movie, I interviewed him at length about it as well. So at the time, everyone was getting excited about derivatives and the profits that could be made for it. And very few people could understand what was going on other than that they were making profits. What's different about the current boom in cryptocurrency and the valuations you've just told us about?
So it's a good question. And of course, Michael's last book, Going Infinite, is about the Sam Bankman-Fried scandal, which I would encourage people to read. But just on the derivatives, basically, and we're going back 15, 16 years ago now, but what Wall Street did was they packaged mortgages. They bundled them, and then they added leverage to them through what you're calling derivatives. And so this leverage cycle works for a period of time. And then what ends up happening is you end up getting a leverage collapse or a boom-bust cycle. That's been very consistent throughout history, by the way. Anytime you add leverage to an equation, at some point, if there's just a mild amount of instability, the situation cracks. The most specific two episodes in my career were the 1998 Russian ruble crisis. Wall Street was very heavily levered. The Russians decided to default on their bonds in August of 1998, result of which all of that leverage had to come out of the system. And, you know, Wall Street lost anywhere from 25 to 30%. Same thing happened in the 2008 crisis. And some of this was inducted by the American government because the American government in the early 2000s basically said that they wanted poorer people, people with lower incomes, to also be able to buy homes. And so these were called subprime mortgages. And what ended up happening was they forced the banks through legislation and regulation to offer out loans to people that had lower than what was typically measured as the income requirements for these mortgages. And so once those people got into a little bit of trouble and weren't able to make their mortgage payments, that leverage came out of the system. And you saw the global financial crisis, and it was literally something like 50% loss in the U.S. stock market. Blockchain is a very, very different thing. And I would encourage you to do more homework on it if you don't know a lot about it. And I would say to you, Matt, that I started as a skeptic. I'm a 60-year-old Wall Street veteran. I've been on Wall Street for 36 years. I think in the year 2012, I think I put out on Twitter that I didn't understand Bitcoin and I didn't need to, that Bitcoin was a bunch of nonsense. But unfortunately, I got that wrong in 2012. And I think what happens is as you do more homework on something and as you spend more time understanding something, very smart people make a decision to change their minds. And so all I would say to you briefly is that the blockchain in general is this wonderful delayering mechanism, and Bitcoin represents a piece of digital property on that highway system. And so just briefly, you and I were in an elevator together. You had to say, hey, what's the blockchain? I would say this is a technology where you and I can transact with each other, where we don't have to have a trusted third party involved. And so throughout history, 5,000 years of history, if you were going to sell me your home, of course, you're going to tell me who your corresponding bank is. We'll agree to a price. I will then wire my money from my corresponding bank to your bank. Your bank will notify you that you've gotten the money, and then you'll hand me over the deed. And so we have a couple of intermediaries in the transaction that we both trust before we will consummate the transaction. What the blockchain allows us to do, it's a verifiable, what we would call a trustless system. I could send value to you over the blockchain. You could receive it in your wallet. You know it's there, safe and secure. And we've cut out those intermediaries. And so this is a wonderful delayering mechanism. And I'll finish the question by just, or the answer to the question by just saying that there's $4 trillion spent globally, $4 trillion U.S. dollars in verifying transactions. So financial services, roughly $7 trillion total, but just in the verification of transactions, wiring fees, all the different things that we do with our banks, it's $4 trillion. So just imagine we could return that back to the economy in terms of research, innovation, and other things. And I think that's what the future is going to be. And I think it's a very exciting part of the future. But like yourself, I started out as a skeptic.
But somebody else who was a skeptic as recently as 7 years ago was the BlackRock chief executive Larry Fink, who called Bitcoin an index of money laundering. But just how big are BlackRock in the market now?
So as of Friday, BlackRock has a $19 trillion Bitcoin ETF. And so the symbol for that is IBIT. SkyBridge, we're very proud to be the first investors in that. So I'll take you back to, this would be January of 2023. And so almost 18 months ago, the BlackRock executives came to us and said that they'd finally convinced Larry that Bitcoin had promise. Larry, as early as mid-2022, I had an opportunity to speak with him in Abu Dhabi at one of the finance conferences there, and he was very negative on Bitcoin. But I think a combination of people inside his firm, some external brilliant people like Pete Brigger, who's the CEO of Fortress. The term is orange pilled. You know, when you get somebody to understand Bitcoin and you get somebody to go down the rabbit hole of understanding the mechanisms behind Bitcoin and what the software really does and why the software is so valuable, why that network which is currently, the Bitcoin network is currently at about $1.5 trillion, and why people honestly believe that that network should be worth the market capitalization of gold, where gold right now is, approximately 16 to 17 trillion. But in Larry's case, he's very negative on Bitcoin, wanted nothing to do with Bitcoin. He shared that view alongside of people like Jamie Dimon, the CEO of JP Morgan, and of course the legendary investor Warren Buffett, the CEO of Berkshire Hathaway. But what changed Larry was detailed research. Some of your listeners or delegates in the audience may know people like Paul Tudor Jones, or have heard of Stanley Druckenmiller. These are legendary hedge fund managers, both of which that have gone down the rabbit hole of Bitcoin, done the research, ended up owning Bitcoin. Mike Novogratz, CEO of Galaxy, a close personal friend of mine for the last 30 years. We worked together at Goldman Sachs, same sort of thing. And so this sort of College of Cardinals reached out to Larry. Larry became a believer. And SkyBridge, my firm, through my partner, Brett Messing, we put $10 million in what started as the BlackRock Bitcoin Trust. This trust was then converted into an ETF once the SEC gave its approval. And of course, I should point out, in 2022, the SkyBridge Bitcoin ETF, my own firm, we filed for an ETF application alongside of Fidelity and others, and we were rejected by the SEC. But of course, the SEC lost the court case with Grayscale, and it created this opening that BlackRock is now benefiting from.
And tell me about the significance of what happened last week in particular when the SEC decided that it would approve ETFs for Ether.
So again, there's a little bit of my political editorialization in this answer, so forgive me, but I sort of like to tell people what I honestly think as opposed to the nonsense that people typically hear. We have a person in our country, the senator from Massachusetts. She's a former law professor at Harvard Law School. She's a 70-plus-year-old woman that hates Bitcoin. I don't know why, actually. No one's ever been able to explain that. She's been asked why. She herself actually cannot explain it. But President Biden cut a deal with her back in November. March of 2020, he said to her, you got to leave the race in order for me to beat Bernie Sanders and become the nominee for the party. And Elizabeth Warren said she would leave the race, but in exchange for that, she wanted to have some say and control over financial services, the SEC and Treasury. President Biden, then Vice President Biden, cut that deal. So she named Janet Yellen Secretary of Treasury. She named a gentleman by the name of Gary Gensler, SEC chairman. Gensler, interestingly enough, was a former MIT professor who taught a course on blockchain. You could actually download that course. You could go to MIT, Professor Gensler. It's an 18-hour course on the blockchain. He was a blockchain enthusiast, but he decided now, due to political reasons, to be very negative on the blockchain, very negative on Bitcoin, et cetera. And so he's done a number of things politically to stop the proliferation and the innovation of blockchain technology here in the United States. Too many things that I could really mention today, but you could just, Google him and you get a list of those things. Now, the good news for the industry, he's lost several court cases. He lost a case against Ripple, where he said that Ripple was a security, meaning it had passed the Howey test. Court said that it did not. He lost a court case against Grayscale, where he did not want to allow for a Bitcoin ETF, even though there are ETPs in Europe and there are several ETFs in Canada. The United States was behind in terms of our regulation. He lost that court case as well. And so now there's a tremendous amount of pressure on him. And last week, Donald Trump, the former president, who's the Republican nominee or the presumptive nominee for the Republicans, announced that he would be pro-crypto. And I just want to point out to everybody listening that in the United States, we have 85 million people that own cryptocurrency. And so there are people here in the United States that own cryptocurrency more than we own dogs in the United States. There are 65 million dog owners. There are 85 million holders of cryptocurrency. And so as a politician, it would almost be like you saying, I'm anti-dog. And so I think President Trump, whether you like or dislike him, he has very good political instincts. He himself was quite negative on Bitcoin when he was president, sent out several tweets related to it. Then Secretary of Treasury Steve Mnuchin said many negative things in public commentary related to Bitcoin at the suggestion of President Trump. But now Mr. Trump has done a 180 and he's pro-Bitcoin. And this has put tremendous pressure on the Democrats. And we believe, and again, this is my opinion based on lots of phone conversations with insiders, we believe that the White House actually put pressure on the SEC to get those Ethereum ETFs approved under the auspices that they don't want to be the anti-crypto party at a time when lots of young people and a lot of people in the U.S. own crypto. So I think it's a breakthrough for crypto, frankly. And I think the good news is it will allow the United States to maintain its mantle of financial services leadership if both presidential candidates are eventually pro-blockchain and pro-crypto.
Fascinating that you say about 85 million people owning crypto, because in the UK, for example, its first cryptocurrency exchange traded products are finally set to begin trading this week, but they're not going to be available to retail investors because the Financial Conduct Authority in the UK has ruled that crypto derivatives are ill-suited for retail consumers due to the harm they pose. What do you make of that?
It's understandable. I think if you know, let me take the side of the anti-crypto enthusiasts for a second. In the United States, during the year 2022, there was rampant fraud exposed, and there was over-leverage in the system, leverage like we were discussing related to the mortgages back in 2008. Lots of people lost money. Lots of small investors, unsophisticated investors, were burned. And those were the ones that got to the headlines. Underneath the headlines were these sort of micro Ponzi schemes where people were ambushed by smaller con artists, if you will. And in fairness to Gary Gensler and Elizabeth Warren and the British regulators, they certainly want to protect the unsophisticated investor from being rubed by a con artist. Now, having said all of that, an exchange-traded product from a reputable firm or an ETF from a reputable firm like BlackRock, I do think is a safe and stable investment for retail. But Bitcoin has expressed tremendous volatility since its inception. The Bitcoin network is approximately 15 years old. Obviously, these coins started at fractions of a penny. It's now grown to 68,000, but the march to 68,000 has been uneven. There's been periods of time where Bitcoin has lost as much as 90% of its value. And so if you held your Bitcoin from the beginning, you're very happy. But I'll just give you an example. My odyssey into Bitcoin, which started in 2012, and I said no. I was revisiting Bitcoin in 2014. I said no. And it wasn't until 2020 that I sort of got what was going on and decided to start investing in Bitcoin. And so I'll just tell people my odyssey. I bought my first Bitcoin at 17,000. I watched Bitcoin go to 69,000. But I'll give you the dates. I bought Bitcoin 17,000 October of 2020, watched it go to 69,000 in November of 2021. And then I watched it return to 15,000 January, February of 2023 after the FTX debacle was exposed. And so that's a very painful ride. It's now back to 68. If I had gone to Mars for 2 years and landed back here on Earth, I'd be fine. But people are emotionally tied to their money and their investments. And a lot of people got shaken out of their Bitcoin holdings during that period of volatility. So I understand where British regulators are on this. But I do think as this product matures, this will become an asset class akin to gold. And regulators around the world will allow retail investors to own it, provided that it has the right safety measures around it. And I think an organization like BlackRock provides that. I can't speak directly to the asset managers in the UK as to which ones are the best ones to hold Bitcoin for customers.
Is there something, though, of an asset price bubble across all classes at present? We've seen the Dow Jones crash through 40,000 mark. The S&P 500 is up again after a bumper year last year. You've told us about what's happening in relation to cryptocurrencies. Is there a danger that after the cheapness of money that we had for a number of years, and that the asset prices have still continued to go up, even as interest rates have gone up, that there's a detachment from reality in relation to the real value of assets?
It's a very good question. I ask myself that question every day, because one of the things that has kept us in business for the last 20 years at SkyBridge is a constant relitigation of our portfolio. And so I look at our assets under management every morning and say, okay, is this the assets that I want on? Suppose I got fresh money today, would the configuration of our portfolio look the way it does? And I think you can only really see the bubble with hindsight. As an example, NVIDIA is trading over $1,000 per share today. I think the growth of that company is exciting, and there's probably a lot of hype in that story. Yet, if I sell my NVIDIA shares, which I happen to own right now, am I going to be right or wrong? There could be a short-term blip down 20, 30, even 50%. But I'm wondering if the long-term trends are in my favor, and that's an exceptional company. And I would just point out to people that the mistakes that I've made in my career have been selling things because of price appreciation. And so I'd like to tell you that I owned Amazon the whole way, but I didn't. But I'll just be brief on this. I bought Amazon on the IPO in 1997, May of 1997, so 27 years ago. And if you had held Amazon, let's say you put $10,000 into Amazon stock 27 years ago, it's worth about $16 million US dollars today. However, you would have had to gone through 20 periods of time where the stock lost at least 50% of its value. One period in March of 2020, where it dropped almost 90% in value. And so one would say, well, was it at a bubble then? And should I have sold it? And how do you time these things? And my response to this is always that if you own high quality things in the market and you're patient, I think you're long-term rewarded. If you're analyzing the market day to day and you're worried about the near term, I think it's the wrong investment to be in the market. It's the wrong investment to be in Bitcoin or stocks. But if you think like a Warren Buffett or you think like a long-term holder, even if we are in a bubble today, and I can't honestly tell you if we are or not until after the fact, rates likely are coming down. I know that this is something that people don't see. People were anticipating a 3 to possibly 4 rate cuts for the United States and our central bank this year. Now they're saying 1 to 2 rate cuts. But I think otherwise. I actually think there'll be at least 3 rate cuts this year. The data that we're looking at, and I would tell people to please go to truflation.com, truflation.com. This is a decentralized aggregator. This is away from the government data. We have a expression, it's a little bit of a cliche, but I think it's worth saying. There are lies, there are damn lies, and then there are statistics. And of course, the government can manipulate these statistics in lots of different ways to make the data, frankly, distorted from reality. But if you go to some place like truflation.com, you'll see that the inflation numbers are trending down, which means that the Fed is going to have to cut rates. And so if the Fed cuts rates, we are definitely not in a bubble, because everybody listening knows this, but it's worth repeating. Interest rates are the financial gravity of financial assets. Lower rates mean higher prices. So I wouldn't be too soon to sell this market here, assuming that it's a bubble. But I do hear what you're saying. Prices are high. I don't want to be like Irving Fisher, though, when in early October of 1929, Irving Fisher told people that stocks had reached a permanent high or a permanent plateau was the exact quote. And of course, 4 months later, the market crashed down 90%. So I've been humbled by life. I've been humbled by markets. I'm not here being overconfident in my assumptions, but I do think that we're okay here given where the proclivity is on rates in the near term, i.e. over the next 12 to 18 months.
When you were with this conference last year, the trial of Sam Bankman-Fried was going on at that time. So now he's convicted, now he's in prison. What do you think of it all now? Has he received an appropriate sentence? And for a wider scale, is it something that the market has shrugged off, that he was like a rogue element who was not representative of what's really going on?
Well, yes. I mean, the answer to the second part of the question is yes. I think the market has shrugged it off. I think it's a more nuanced, and I'm probably more sensitive about this because I was close to Sam, and I think I said this last year at this event that I trusted Sam and I liked Sam, and so it was very sad for me and it was heartbreaking to see unfold what actually unfolded. And my recommendation to Sam was to come clean, tell the truth, negotiate with the prosecutors. He would have gotten a way lighter sentence. The three young people that pled guilty all got lighter sentences or fines, or in one case, no sentence. Sam was the kingpin, if you will. So he probably would have been penalized with a jail term, but I don't think he would have gotten 25 years. And so just to explain to people quickly, if you'd make a decision in the United States, you're under federal prosecution and they've asserted various crimes against you. If you make a decision not to plea out or to plead guilty to something and have a plea bargaining situation with the prosecutors, if they go to trial and you are successfully, you know, prosecuted as guilty, then there's a sentencing grid that the prosecutors have to follow. And of course, they tell you all this before you begin that process. And so the bottom part of that sentencing grid was 25 years. The top part for what Sam did was 35. And so the judge gave him the more lenient side of that. But you're asking me if I think it's fair. You know, listen, people are mad at me for saying this, and he hurt me. He hurt my reputation. He hurt my business. I got a lot of negative press as a result of my relationship with Sam. But I feel bad about the situation, frankly. And I think that Sam, while misguided, everybody got their money back at the end of the day. And this was really a process issue for Sam. And if you, you know, since you mentioned Michael Lewis, if you read his book, the book that he wrote about Sam Bankman-Fried, the title of the book is Going Infinite. I think he makes a pretty clear case, and he spent 6 months of his life with Sam, very, very close. I think he makes a pretty clear case that there may have been some criminality, but it wasn't as broad-based as what was asserted. So I'd like to see his sentence commuted, frankly. I don't think he deserves 25 years. Having said that, I understand why he got 25, and he didn't listen to really good advice from a lot of criminal defense attorneys, which would have told him to plead out with the prosecution. But that case is behind us. I will say this, because I want to be balanced, and I know there's a lot of young people that you guys are sharing this information with. I don't like Gary Gensler. I don't like Elizabeth Warren. I think they, by and large, have hurt the United States in terms of the way they go about regulation. And I would suggest that we think about regulation in terms of what is right or wrong for the country, as opposed to what's hard left or hard right. I think we've overly politicized our regulatory process. But I will give Gary Gensler credit for this. He, regulatorily, if you look at our laws, when he approved the Bitcoin futures, there's a clause in administrative law in the United States that says that you cannot be the administrator, in this case, Gary Gensler, cannot be arbitrary and capricious in terms of the administration of the law. And so when he approved the Bitcoin futures ETF, I was asked on television, well, what do I think about the cash or the spot ETF? I said, well, that'll get approved in 3 months because that's the law. Gensler held back that approval. Now, you could say he broke the law. I'm not saying that, but he was sued. And the lawsuit contended that he acted in an arbitrary and capricious way. And of course, he lost the suit. But I will say this, the positive byproduct of Gary Gensler delaying that ETF was he opened up the seam in the marketplace to expose all this fraud and all this over leverage. And so even though he didn't administer the law pursuant to the way the letter of the law was written, I do think that Gary Gensler helped the industry by cleaning out lots of fraud, lots of over leverage. And so we sit here today at a $68,000 number for Bitcoin. That's a sturdier, less levered number than the 69,000 in November of 2021. So there are always silver linings to this sort of stuff.
Over your shoulder in our shot, over your right shoulder, there's a poster of Superman. That's not one of those Superman posters that had Donald Trump in it, is it?
No, that's like the real Superman. Could you imagine Donald Trump naked? I mean, I'm telling you, he does not look like Superman, this poor guy, you know?
Well, we know from Stormy Daniels a few things about that.
Unfortunately, he's overcompensated. Yeah, after listening to Stormy discuss his anatomy, you know he's overcompensating all that hypermasculinity and the high heels in his shoes and the orange war paint. You know, there's a lot of compensation this poor guy is going through in his life. But you know, the truth be told, he's very close in the polls. And I think he's going to lose. But this election is way too close. It doesn't need to be this close. And it just speaks to what the hard left is doing in the country, that the middle roadsters in the country, sort of the people that are more moderate, don't like that culture that the hard left is imposing on the country. And this is one of the reasons why Trump is close in the polls.
I'll get to that in one moment, but you mentioned about the prison sentence that Sam Bankman-Fried got. Could Donald Trump avoid prison no matter what he did? He might be convicted in the next few days or weeks on the current trial, but even if he was to do what he once threatened, walk out into Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody, has he reached a stage where it is impossible to imprison Donald Trump no matter what he does?
Well, I think the more despicable thing about him is that he's broken all of the norms and all of what we thought were the fair gentlemanly or gentlewomanly protocols in our society. And so when our founders were envisioning who would end up in the presidency, I don't think they were thinking of rogues like this. And so he has stretched the norms. If you put Trump in jail, you set up the dominoes that really hurt the United States and create a banana-like republic where we're starting to jail our political adversaries. So even though he may have committed these crimes, I think it's very hard to put him in jail because you don't want one part of the country to believe that he's been put into jail for political purposes as opposed to legal and factual purposes. And so I just remind people historically in the United States that Richard Nixon resigned from the presidency August 8, 1974. By mid-September, his successor, President Gerald Ford, had pardoned him and basically said whatever crimes that he had committed, what the United States is going to forgive, and he offered him a presidential pardon. Now, there was a uproar at the time. Senator Ted Kennedy, Jack Kennedy's brother, fellow Irishman, who was in the Senate representing Massachusetts at that time, rebuked Gerald Ford. He said this was a disaster, travesty of justice, and Mr. Nixon needed to be jailed. In 2009, when Senator Kennedy was dying from brain cancer, he wrote his last memoir, and he spent a whole chapter on this, and he wrote in there that he had made a mistake in September of 1974. He said that he wanted Nixon to go to jail, but he realized over the ensuing 30 plus years that that would have been the wrong thing for the country, that ultimately Gerald Ford was wise to pardon Nixon because it put down the politics of the situation. And of course, he said something apocryphal in that chapter. He said, well, of course, you know, this will likely not happen again, but here we are with Donald Trump. I think it'd be a mistake to put him in jail. He may or may not be convicted in this trial that's going on here in New York. He's got two other cases both of which are probably more damning for Mr. Trump. The documents case, where he stole classified documents and put them in his bathroom at Mar-a-Lago, why we know that some of our intelligence agents in the field have died since those documents were taken from the White House. And so, you know, you have people in the agency and various intelligence departments of the U.S. government that are very sore about this. And then the last case, which I think was two other cases, frankly, there's the election fraud case in Georgia. We'll have to see what happens there. But the other case is the insurrection case. They got him on tape, you know, Mark Meadows. You know, when Trump says, well, this is lawfare and this is a Soros-sponsored African-American prosecutor coming after him, it's just not true. In the insurrection case, Mark Meadows, the very white Christian conservative who ran the Freedom Caucus for the House of Representatives in our country, who was Mr. Trump's last chief of staff, is the chief witness for the prosecution. So they have him on tape explaining what he was trying to do. They have him on tape with reckless disregard for the vice president's life. I mean, there is a reason why Vice President Trump, who was on the ballot with Donald Trump in both 2016 and 2020, is not endorsing him. Moreover, you know, we've got a lot of political cowards in this country. This guy, Kevin McCarthy, who's a spineless jellyfish. I mean, hopefully you'll get a chance to interview this guy. I mean, he's exactly my age, but he looks 500 because he's lied for the last 10 years for Donald Trump. And, you know, now he looks like Grandpa Munster from the Munsters. But this guy could have put Trump lights out through the ropes on the 7th of January, had him impeached in the House, which he was, and then convicted in the Senate. They had the votes to do that, but they chickened out. And so now we're dealing with Trump again here in 2024. Now, I predict he'll lose this election. But since they won't put him in jail, we'll be dealing with an 82-year-old Donald Trump in 2028. We'll have to defeat him again. And while he's doing all this, he has decimated the center-right party, which, you know, are the Republicans. But I think that Republican Party is really almost on the way out, the way the Whig Party, frankly, was on the way out prior to the Lincoln election in 1860.
That level of analysis is why I've recommended The Rest is Politics US as a really entertaining and informative weekly listen. But something else that strikes me is that the economy seems to be going very well in the US at present. We've mentioned the stock market indices, the price of gold, various other things. Inflation is falling. Interest rates are going to come down. And there was a saying, I think going back to the Bill Clinton era, it's the economy, stupid. That's what dictated people's voting. So why is that not the case for Joe Biden? Why is he not able to sell his success in economics to win this election?
It's a really good question. And so I'll start out by answering it like this. Joe Biden no longer looks like your grandfather. He looks like your great-grandfather. And so it's almost impossible for him to do what he needs to do, which is to get out there and sell that agenda. And he's been unsuccessful at doing that. Lots of gaffes. He's a lifelong stutterer. I think I mentioned this on The Rest is Politics. He broke his foot a while back. They put his foot in one of these big boots. They told him, you got to leave it on for 10 to 12 weeks. He didn't like the boot. He thought the boot was bad optics for him. So he took the boot off after 2 weeks. And that was a mistake. He can barely put any weight on his right foot. And so if you watch him doddering around, the foot break has made him look older than he actually is, or older than his physicality actually asserts. I mean, he's on the Peloton bike every morning working out. He's in way better shape mentally and physically than the press or Donald Trump want to give him credit for. And I think we'll see that on display during the debates. But he just cannot get out there to sell that economic agenda that you're talking about. Second part of the answer has to do with inflation. Unfortunately, in the United States, we inducted too much money into the system during COVID. We reduced interest rates to zero, and we sent trillions of dollars into the system. And I'll point out to people listening, when you do something like that, you're going to cause inflation. And so we like to personalize things on our politicians that are situational. So in the 1990s, 90s during the Gulf War. We went into a recession. That was George Bush's recession. When the Gulf War ended and the economy started to boom, well, that was Bill Clinton's economic recovery. And so we blamed one politician and we favored the other, but it was really just cyclicality. Had Donald Trump won the election in 2020, this would be Donald Trump's inflation. But he didn't win the election. The inflation would have been there one way or the other, but it's being fingered and blamed on Joe Biden. And this is having a big impact on the polls. And I'll just point out to people, and this perhaps is another case for Bitcoin, the United States, the U.S. dollar has lost 25% of its purchasing power since January of 2020. So in a 4.5 year period of time, we've hit the dollar by 25%. If you're a middle income person in the U.S. or a lower income person, you are feeling that. You're feeling that price at the pump. You're feeling that in terms of your grocery bill, your utilities bills, and et cetera. And that could make you want to make a political change. So the Biden campaign would be well advised to get some younger people out there to advocate on behalf of the president, explain why this happened. It's really not his fault, but also explain some of the good things that he's done. And I'll just be brief. I'll name two. One is the CHIPS Act, where we've got all these microprocessor foundries are here back in the United States. And the second thing is the infrastructure bill, which in addition to rebuilding roads, bridges, and tunnels, we're also reshoring a lot of our manufacturing. All of this has happened in the last 3.5 years in the Biden administration. And despite Trump's rhetoric, it did not happen in the 4 years that he was president.
So why is it that so many people in big business are in favor of Trump over Biden, particularly when, and this is something else you said on The Rest Is Politics, Trump is effectively threatening to deport 15 million people if he returns to power, people who are very important in the workplace and without whom the American economy might not function properly?
Well, I mean, it's more than that. I mean, let's just say that what we'll call the 15 million, I guess he's going to go around in like Handmaid's Tale Brinks trucks, these armored vehicles, I guess, and swoop people out of their houses with machine guns and take them out of the country. I guess that's something that he wants to do, which is, to me, quintessentially un-American. The second thing he wants to do is he wants to double up the tariffs with China. Now, we're in a cold war with China. We're in a lukewarm or somewhat lukewarm economic competition with China. So even President Biden has anteed up some more tariffs on China. Well, it's a small part of the economy, but the rhetoric is there. But I mean, I could name 15 things that Mr. Trump wants to do that are un-American, that are anti-business. Particularly if you're a communications executive, he wants to take your FCC license. He's been very open about this. If you disagree with him, he wants to take your FCC license away from you. He's also said to two of his former defense lawyers, one of which is a personal friend of mine, that he wants to use the FBI as a Gestapo. Now, what that gentleman also said was the good news is he doesn't know anything about history, so he doesn't even know what the Gestapo means, but he wants to do this. But business leaders are for Trump because of the imagery that Trump represents. He is a business person in their minds. The prior to COVID, the economy more or less did okay under Trump. And, business leaders, they don't like the left-leaning cultural issues that Mr. Biden is bringing with him. And they don't like all that stuff. And so that's why they're probably for Trump. But it's a mistake. And I've tried to point out to people, whether it's on The Rest Is Politics, my public remarks on television, or even my remarks here, that Mr. Trump is threatening the legal stability of the United States. Mr. Trump is suggesting that he'll corrupt our legal precedent, and at his whim, he'll do certain things like go after his adversaries using the FBI, persecute people. He's suggested openly that he wants dictatorial powers. There's something in the United States called expanded or unitary executive power. If you look up unitary executive power on Google, you'll see what the Heritage Foundation is saying about knocking out the other two articles of the Constitution and making the executive branch way more powerful. All of this stuff is very dangerous for the world. I don't know why the business leaders think he's more positive, but I do think it's a cultural issue.
But very quickly to finish, Anthony, because I'm conscious we're at the end of our time. But I do want to ask you, you have said that you believe he will not win. Is that wishful thinking in your part, though? Because the polls in 5 of the 6 swing states say that he will win. So all your worst nightmares could come to pass. So is it wishful thinking in your part when you say that Biden will win?
I don't think it's wishful thinking. I'm a fairly objective person. I understand why people think that Trump could win. If you look at those polls and you look at the Real Clear Politics averages, most of those polls have the president, meaning President Biden, inside the margin of error. It's sort of a 1 to 2% differential. Campaign really has not heated up yet. It's very, very early. And I pointed out on The Rest is Politics, and I'll share with you guys here, President Biden spent $35 million over the last 2 months building field offices in these swing states. And I'll submit to everybody here, these are two entities, these are two political figures that are known by the American people for the last 50 years. It's not like someone's waking up this morning saying, God, I got to see what they say in the debate before I make my decision. I mean, these are people that are well known. It's not the Barack Obama 2008 introductory tour, and a result of which this will be a get out the vote exercise. The Democrats are more organized. They have more of the registrations. I'll just point out to everybody listening, it's independents first at 41%, Democrats in the low 30s in terms of their registrations in the U.S., Republicans in the high 20s. And so this sort of stuff favors the Democrats when you get into a nail-biting election like this. And this is a get-out-the-vote exercise. They will outman the Trump campaign because they have more money than the Trump campaign. And a lot of these things do come down to money. But we'll have to see. There's gaffes that could happen. There are October surprises and things like that. And as I said earlier, I've been humbled by life and markets, and so I could be wrong. But I got it right in 2020. I said Mr. Trump would lose when the consensus was favoring him. I said he would win in 2016 when the consensus was not favoring him there. And the consensus right now narrowly favors him. But I think this will be the incumbent's race to lose. The economy will get stronger. Rates will get cut by the back half of this year. And this will be a big get-out-the-vote exercise that the Democrats are really good at.
Anthony Scaramucci, there's loads more if we had time that I'd love to ask you, but it's been terrific having you for the last 3/4 of an hour. Thank you very much for joining us in New York.
Thank you, guys. Buy some Bitcoin, Matt. Get off zero, Matt. Buy some Bitcoin.
And that's it for today's Magnified. Hope you enjoyed it. Lots of other interviews from this series that you can go back and listen to if you want. And if you'd liked it, you'd recommend it, please, to a friend, wherever it is you're listening to it, be it Apple, Spotify, or, of course, on the Go Loud app. And, of course, big thanks again to our sponsors at Volkswagen Financial Services Business Leasing. Looking to upgrade your business fleet? Choose from a wide range of vehicles local to you. Visit vwfs.ie/business. Volkswagen Financial Services is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland.
Go Loud presents Magnified with Matt Cooper, proudly sponsored by Volkswagen Financial Services Business Leasing. Looking to upgrade your business fleet? Choose from a wide range of vehicles local to you. Visit vwfs.ie/business.
Volkswagen Financial Services is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Go Loud. Sounds better with us.